WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
For Terry Gross, while she starts a two-week vacation. And you're listening to WUHY-FM in Philadelphia. Let me point out some upcoming jazz events on WUHY. On New Year's Eve, National Public Radio will continue with a tradition they started a few years ago of an all-night New Year's Eve special. And one thing that we're very proud about this year is that the New Year's Eve special will begin in Philadelphia with a performance by Grover Washington Jr., Pieces of a Dream and Sunny Fortune. This will be taking place at Ripley Music Hall. That starts at 9:30, a week from Thursday, which is New Year's Eve, and continues until 5 a.m. On Fresh Air, we have a couple special concerts coming up on Tuesday, January 5th. That's the first Tuesday in January after the New Year's. At 4 o'clock, Bob Dureau, pianist, singer, and composer based in the Delaware Valley, we'll perform and talk with Terry Gross about his music. That's Tuesday, January 5th at 4 o'clock. And a week from tomorrow, next Wednesday at 4 o'clock, Sam Dockery, who is a jazz pianist who's played with a number of different people, including Clifford Brown and Art Blakey, will be in our studios for a solo jazz piano concert. And we would like to invite you to come to our studios and be part of the studio audience if you'd like. We'd ask you to get here at 3:30. That's a week from Wednesday, and our studios are at 6th and Race Streets on Independence Mall. If you'd like to come, you're welcome, but there are a limited number of seats, and you must give us a call to let us know that you'd like to come. So here's a phone number for that that you can call during business hours until 5 o'clock today and talk to Angela. That's 351-9200. Again, that's a solo piano concert with Sam Dockery next Wednesday, a week from tomorrow at 4 o'clock on Fresh Air. With me now on Fresh Air is novelist Chaim Potok, who is the author of 5 novels, all exploring the theme of being Jewish in America and different questions of faith and tradition which are encountered by the characters in his stories. His novels include The Chosen, The Promise, My Name is Asher Lev, and most recently The Book of Lights, which is published by Knopf. This is the story of a rabbinical student, Gershon Loran, who grows up in Brooklyn and, as a student, finds himself drawn towards Kabbalah, the mystical interpretation of Jewish scriptures, a set of writings which have never had an easy acceptance by some members of the Jewish scholarly establishment. It is felt by many that there are dangers associated with Kabbalah and that in that its study can lead to irreconcilable questions of faith. Gershon goes to Korea as an army chaplain, where he is forced to think about the significance of Judaism in a very different context. Much of this is autobiographical. Chaim Potok was trained and ordained as a rabbi and served in Korea as a U.S. Army chaplain. In Wanderings, Chaim Potok's History of the Jews, he writes this in his introduction. I entered the American army. I too crossed an ocean. In the shattered villages of Korea, in the exquisite temples of Japan, in the teeming Chinese hovels of Hong Kong, in the vile back streets of Macau, all the neat antique coherence of my past came undone. Once we bulldozed a piece of Korean earth on our compound to lay a cement foundation for a Quonset hut and discovered a mass grave of children who had been butchered during the Korean War. We were always finding such graves in Korea. No one seemed to know who had done the killing. No one really cared. We'd cover them over and build elsewhere. My early decades had prepared me for everything except the two encounters I, in fact, experienced. A meeting with a vast complex of cultures perfectly at ease without Jews and Judaism, and a confrontation with the beautiful and the horrible in the world of Oriental human beings. It was not the anguish of my own people that sundered me, that I had come to accept as part of our destiny, but the loveliness and the suffering I saw in the lives of pagans. Jewish history began in a world of pagans. My own Judaism was transformed in another such world. I've spent the subsequent decades in an evolving reshaping of my faith. I've done this by writing novels. That is my personal way of giving shape to thought. The novels are about certain kinds of culture conflicts in the present. This book is about the past that led to this present. That's from the introduction to Chaim Potok's History of the Jews, which is called Wanderings. Chaim Potok was for many years the editor-in-chief of the Jewish Publication Society of America, and he and his family divide their time between their homes in Philadelphia and Jerusalem. Welcome to Fresh Air, Chaim. Happy Hanukkah.
Thank you.
How much of the book is autobiographical?
I think that most writers who write seriously inside the discipline or the genre we call serious modern literature utilize their own lives as raw material for their creativity. This is certainly true for the past 300 years or so of serious novel writing. The only exception that I know to that is Stephen Crane's Red Badge of Courage. Stephen Crane knew nothing firsthand about the Civil War, but was able to research it quite effectively and utilize his sense of what it was like to be on a playing field, a sports field. I suppose you would say extrapolate from that the kind of fear and terror and excitement of an individual caught in a field of combat. Even Hemingway, who researched The Farewell to Arms to a very great extent, didn't quite come as close to Stephen Crane's lack of experience, because Hemingway did indeed experience some aspect of the Italian front during the First World War. But A Farewell to Arms and certainly Red Badge of Courage are really the only exceptions that I personally know of. Most of the time you write about a world that you know best, about your own vision of that world, the way your own sensibility, your own eyes, your inside eyes, as it were, the way those eyes see that world. And clearly you use your own life and your own world as the raw material for what you're writing.
When did your interest in Kabbalah begin? Because so many of the questions that your main character in the Book of Lights asks of himself are wrapped up in his pursuit of Kabbalah.
Well, I grew up in a very Orthodox home, and there was much in that home that was Hasidic. My mother is a descendant of an old and great Hasidic dynasty. My father was a pietist himself. While I was not the garb-wearing and earlock-wearing kind of pietist, I was indeed very much involved in that world, and you would well. And Kabbalah, or Kabbalah, which is the modern Hebrew pronunciation of that old word, Kabbalah, the accent on the last syllable, wafted through the air of the family now and then, and I would read a book about it or listen to my father talk about it. Listen to some of my friends in the school talk about it. Somehow it was always relegated to the back burner of things Jewish. There was a mysterious aura about it. You had the feeling that you walked on very, very shaky ground. You were entering forbidden territory if you really started to take up with this seriously. And it wasn't until my 20s that I began to look into it to some extent, largely as a result of the reading that I did in the scholarly works of Professor Gershom Scholem.
Was the study of Kabbalah at all regarded, like it is in your book, The Book of Lights, as something that's really dangerous, that's something that could really shake your faith if you didn't have the basis on which to understand or interpret the readings?
Generally, the tradition tended to regard mystical studies as fraught with at least a potentiality for menace, for danger. I think the reason for that probably is this. Judaism is essentially a faith based on covenants, a faith based on a legal system. The mystical imagination, with its extraordinary flights, utilizes not the rational element of the human being, but what I suppose might be called the element of the religious imagination. Now, the imagination is very mercurial, very volcanic. It has no boundaries. It flies. It soars. And you don't really know how to control it or where it will take you. And generally, any established faith, any institutionalized faith, looks with a dreary eye upon extraordinary flights of fancy. And I suppose that's, at rock bottom, one of the reasons why mystical flights were regarded with suspicion.
There seems to be also a, well, professional rivalry in an academic setting between the people who would advocate study of Talmud and the study of Kabbalah, which again was regarded at the back burner. Did that exist for you when you were a seminary student?
I think that generally in the Jewish tradition, Talmudic studies are regarded as the measure of an individual. And how you excel in Talmud is the way you're measured. This dichotomy between Kabbalah and Talmud is a fairly recent one in Jewish history. The rabbis of the Talmudic period really didn't see this dichotomy in the way that we see it today. And many of the great rabbis of the Talmudic period were what we would regard as individuals who were steeped both in the law and in mystical experience as well. Yes, there was the notion, even in the Talmud, that the mystical experience was somewhat dangerous, but that didn't mean that a rabbi who engaged in mystical experience was looked upon with a jaundiced eye. And there are instances in the Talmud of rabbis who did indeed make these soaring flights. It wasn't called the Kabbalah, by the way, in the Talmud. It was called, if they call it at all by any name, we call it today Merkava mysticism. Merkava meaning the chariot, the throne chariot of God, that vision that Ezekiel spoke about. And it was this throne chariot of God, and indeed the divine presence himself, that these rabbis hungered to somehow get to. It's really very late in Jewish history that the break occurs between the two. And if you ask me later on about late medieval mysticism, the mysticism called Lurianic Kabbalah, we'll talk about the reasons for that break and why it is that Judaism, for the longest time, really began to look upon Kabbalah with a very sour eye, and why it is that Kabbalah, even to this day, is relegated by most Orthodox Jews, traditional Jews, to the back burner of things Jewish.
I know that in your history of the Jews, you write about how in the 13th century, the mystical nature of Kabbalah was associated with the coming of the Messiah, and I guess that was not a chapter in Jewish history which really panned out too well.
Well, it wasn't the 13th century. It was later than that. Actually, in that century, in earlier centuries, Kabbalists were a sort of esoteric elitist group inside Judaism. Here and there, there would be schools of Kabbalists. And essentially, these were individuals who were great rabbis, for the most part, and as it were on the side, would practice a kind of effort to commune with the higher powers, as it were, a kind of climbing to toward confrontation with the divine. Never a dissolution of themselves in the divine. There was always the sense that the divine was there to be met with, not dissolved into. The notion of the divine being something into which you vanish is not a Jewish mystical notion. It was after the expulsion from Spain in 1492, an expulsion which traumatized the Jewish people and utterly annihilated the Jewish community of Spain, and a great community it was, of about 300,000 or so Jews, a magnificent community, which was literally destroyed overnight. It was, I suppose, the equivalent to that period of time, to what we would regard as the Holocaust of the 20th century. The question arose, why? What had these Jews done, if anything, that might explain this extraordinary tragedy? Now, what happened was, and it often happens this way, in a little town on a hilltop in the Galilee in northern Palestine, A group of Jews would meet periodically and study Kabbalistic texts. And in the early 1500s, an extraordinary young man came to this town. His name was Luria, Isaac Luria. He was a rabbi. And in the 2 years that he lived in that town, he died very young, he taught a remarkable new version of Kabbalah, which was an effort on his part to explain what went wrong with the world and why it is that things just don't work in the world in which we live. This system of Kabbalah is called Lurianic Kabbalah. And it is this system which is volatile and mercurial. And it can be briefly explained as follows. In the creation of the world, the Creator, God, slowly began to withdraw His essence because God is immaterial by definition, since matter is corruptible. In the withdrawing, those areas from which the presence of God was withdrawn slowly became filled with what we regard today as the material world. In the boundaries between the pure essence of God and this materiality, the light of God was contained in very thin vessels. And somehow, during the process of creation, something went wrong. Even God couldn't control a very delicate balancing act that was involved in this boundary between light and matter. And the vessels broke. And the light, the pure, charged light of the divine, fell into the dross of matter, and the lights were trapped. The universe is awry from the very beginning of creation as a result of this miscalculation on the part of the divinity. I must say, it doesn't take much imagination to realize how extraordinary and astonishing and audacious a concept this is. Even God made this incredible mistake at the beginning of things. Even God couldn't control the act of creation. Therefore, things are wrong. Therefore, the job of the human being is somehow to get the sparks out of the dross of matter. Because so long as the divine is trapped in the corporeal, in matter, things are simply going to continue to be very bad for the universe. And it becomes the task, and this is also an audacious notion, of the Jew, through his acts, through the performance of the commandments, somehow to penetrate through the shells that surround this sacred light and redeem the light. And the more light you redeem, the closer you come to the redemption of the world. Therefore, action is charged with messianism. Because the more you act in consonance with the divine commandments, the closer automatically you come to redeeming the broken world in which we live. A step from that is someone who comes and says, the world is already redeemed.
What happened to Rabbi Luria, the author of this?
Nothing. He's regarded as one of the extraordinary personalities in the history of Kabbalah. This was a remarkable step forward, a very rich step in Kabbalah, and a profound response on the part of Kabbalists to a very serious problem, the problem of how you reconcile the destruction of a great Jewish community with a good God.
One of the characters in your book, who is a Kabbalist that your main character studies with, says that every Jewry has had its own mysticism, and then he wonders, what will American Jewry produce as its mysticism? I guess you can draw an analogy between the Spanish Inquisition and the Holocaust and a mysticism that followed from such an event. Can you expound on what the Kabbalists in your book might have had in mind about what would the contemporary American Jewish mysticism be?
I'm not altogether sure what sort of mysticism can work for this very material world in which we live today. I rather suspect, if there is going to be any mystical quality to reality, it may have something to do with the nature of the ambiguity of life. We don't have answers the way we had answers 400 or 500 years ago, 1,000 years ago. And slowly, I think we're coming to learn a measure of peace with the grim reality of the fact that indeed there may not be any final answers to anything, simply a constant procession of questions. And the real question at that point is, how do you live fruitfully? How do you live a committed existence with ambiguity? Evil is ambiguous, good is ambiguous. No matter what it is that you build for yourself, there's going to be something wrong with it. No matter what sort of great theory you come up with, somebody's going to spoil it. Geniuses have to destroy in order to create. All of this seems to be built into the reality of things. And we're slowly, I think, coming face to face with that rather desolate truth. And I suspect that if there's going to be a mysticism in the future, it may very well be the kind of mysticism in which individuals soar not upward, but inward. The sort of mysticism or mystical experience that Gershon Loren had in the end of the Book of Lights.
Let me ask you, that's the name of your main character. Is there any significance to how you named him?
Gershon is named after a biblical a name, Gershom, which means I was a stranger there. And if anyone is a stranger, it's that boy. And Loren is a long-range navigational instrument used for navigation.
Right, sure.
And if anyone's trying to navigate in this world, again, it's that individual, and that's the reason for the name.
Throughout his studies, especially when he's first beginning to learn Kabbalah, he's encouraged to learn Aramaic, which is the language in which Kabbalah is written. What's the mystical significance of that language?
It was the language of the Talmud for the most part, and it was the language of the Talmud because it was the street language at that time. If the Talmud were being written today, the language would be English.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
If the Talmud, let's say, were being composed in the Middle Ages, the language would be Yiddish. It was composed at a period of time when Aramaic was the lingua franca of the ancient world, sort of the international language. And therefore, the Talmud is in Aramaic, the Kabbalah is in Aramaic as well.
The title of your last book is The Book of Lights, and obviously light is a metaphor throughout the book and throughout Judaism in some ways. How does light function as a metaphor in Judaism?
It functions not only in Judaism, but all through the ancient world. One of the problems, of course, that the ancients had was to find a metaphor for any discussion about the nature of God, the essential reality of God. And they saw that light was something that seemed not to be material to them. Clearly, they couldn't understand light as we understand it today. It wasn't material substance, and at the same time, it had effect. It warmed you. It changed the appearance of things. It seemed to be constant. It was precisely because of these qualities of light that they began to utilize light as a metaphor for the essential nature of the divine. Of course, the light in the Book of Lights is, on the one hand, this Kabbalistic light and the extraordinary preoccupation of physicists in our century to somehow trap and utilize the energy, which is the source of light, and the result being the atomic bomb that was ultimately dropped on Japan. The death light, as the atomic physicists called it.
You were speaking before about how I think the parents of both yourself and of your wife come from Hasidic traditions.
Mine.
Just
not
yours.
My wife. My wife's parents come from the other kind of tradition, the very rational and anti-Hasidic tradition in Judaism.
Well, I'd like to, before we finish here, ask perhaps how that was reconciled, those two different traditions in your family. wondering now if the role of religion in your neighborhood has played a very big part in your novels. The novel that you just wrote is set in Brooklyn, and you grew up in New York, didn't you?
Yes. I think that the role of religion in my family is really the significant ambience from which I drew the world in the novels. The neighborhood wasn't a terribly religious neighborhood, although I did live for a time in Brooklyn, and that was substantially religious. One could sense a holiday, a festival, a Sabbath in that particular neighborhood in Brooklyn.
Do you keep in touch with your childhood friends and people that you knew that might enter into your stories?
Yes, from time to time I stumble across them. And it's interesting to see what's happened to us over the years.
Do people assume correctly or incorrectly that they're figuring into your stories?
Yes, everybody seems to find himself in the stories. And very often they surprise me by pointing out things that indeed are true, and I simply brought them up out of the unconscious pool that all writers dip into as they write, and you simply forget what the origin of the thing is.
How did you enter the army as a Jewish chaplain? That's something, again, that Gershon Loren in your book is. He's an army chaplain in Korea, and you were also. How did that come about?
Well, army service was required of us when we attended the seminary. This was the Jewish Theological Seminary in the early 50s during the Korean War. We were volunteered, as it were, for the service, and I ended up in Korea. In other words, before you could enter the rabbinate, you had to do your 2 years in the army as a chaplain.
Right. It wasn't quite volunteerism because otherwise the alternative was essentially not graduating.
That's correct.
Yeah.
That's correct.
What were your duties as a as an army chaplain?
Well, ostensibly the duties, if you're on a base here in the States, would be to care for the welfare, spiritual and I suppose social, of Jewish personnel. But all of that went by the board the moment you hit a combat zone, and of course that was Korea. I got to Korea immediately after the war, or soon after the war, and I had more non-Jewish personnel that I had to worry about than Jewish personnel. I was chaplain of special troops, which was reconnaissance and MPs and quartermaster and engineers and so on.
What does a chaplain do in something like that if you're not conducting services or making preparations for holidays?
A lot of counseling. A lot of broken people, a lot of lonely and suffering people, a lot of young kids in a lot of trouble, and character guidance lectures. Extraordinary amount of work to be done. And I must say that I found the chaplaincy in Korea one of the most worthwhile periods of time in my life. It's the only pulpit that I've ever had, Korea. And with all the anguish and all the suffering and all the hardships and all the frozen nights and all the bouncing around in the jeeps and the many times I came very close to losing my life, with all of that, it was more than a worthwhile experience. We touched lives in Korea in ways you simply cannot do in the States.
How would people confront their own sense of religion, Jewishness or Christianity or whatever, in such a life-threatening situation? Did people undergo changes that chose to come up and talk to you about it?
I think that the experience accelerated and heightened what was already latent in every individual. I'm not altogether certain that a combat experience transforms an individual. I think that you are pretty much what you are by the time you get into the army. And what happens is that the army, certainly a combat situation, acts as an enormous pressure cooker and simply forces you into being what you are sooner and quicker than you normally would be. So if you were, let's say, a latent atheist, you're going to become, I think, if you're really a latent atheist, you're going to become an atheist as a result of your army experience. And if you have in you an iota of religious feeling, that's going to come out as a result of that army or that combat experience.
The army chaplain in your book, Gershon, that spends a lot of time preparing character guidance lectures. And I didn't really know how to relate to that because I've never served in the army and never been in that type of situation in which somebody's giving me a character guidance lecture. My concept of a character guidance lecture might be like a silly lecture I'd have to sit through in high school, something that's compulsory so that I'll have good values, and something that's sort of besides the point in life. But that's such a different context. What were the meaning of the character guidance lectures that you would give and how
were
they received?
I'm not altogether sure that your description of it is too far from the reality of the Army, at least when I was in the Army. I don't know what sort of character guidance lectures are given now. But for the most part, these were package lectures. Chaplains were given books, and the lecture was pretty well outlined for the chaplain. And much of it depended simply upon your own imagination and your own presentation and the style, the rhetoric that you used. The troops were marched into the lecture hall and marched out, and it was compulsory. And the one time that one of the ways that you knew that you were really getting home with a character guidance lecture was if somebody went up to the chief of chaplains and complained. And that happened to me once when the venereal disease rate of the division really began to soar, and the chaplains decided that it was really time to hit home. And I gave a very strong character guidance lecture and talked about home and their mothers and their sisters, and was very dramatic, and was told afterwards by my division chaplain that I was just a bit too dramatic, because some sergeants had complained that I had shaken up the troops a bit too much. And so my character guidance lecture schedule was cut back. That's one of the ways you knew that you were getting there. But if you really got there, I suppose, too effectively and shook up people, you were in a measure of difficulty. I'm not altogether certain that the character guidance lecture is the best way to do that kind of moral teaching. I'm not altogether certain that I know how to do it with troops in a situation of that kind, very far from home in a very strange country, and the accessibility to prostitution and to all kinds of libidinous activity, shall we say, is very easy. It's right up front. I really don't know how to handle a situation of that kind. My own feeling is that the best way to handle it is on a one-to-one basis. Unfortunately, the only time you actually saw someone on a one-to-one basis was when it was too late, when that individual was already in trouble.
Yeah, it seems that as an Army chaplain, what you might be effectively called on to do, more or less, is to provide spiritual support for more effective fighting, sort of like a moral might for right type of thing. I remember in Patton, in the movie Patton, Patton asked the chaplain, he just pulls the chaplain on duty and says, say me a prayer for good weather tomorrow, and he had to do it. And the chaplain had the dilemma of, well, I'm glad to be able to provide, to do whatever I can to provide good weather, but on the other hand, I have this dilemma of having my hand in an action which is just going to end up in people killing each other and more effective approach to killing. Was that a dilemma at all?
I think less so in Korea than it might have been in Vietnam. I was pretty much convinced that though Korea was an empire situation, the American Empire against whatever, the Red Empire or so on, that there was a measure of right on our side. Of course, I really do believe that the Russians are a menace to the peace of the world. I'm not entirely certain that I would have felt that way in Vietnam. My feeling is that if I really hadn't been convinced that our presence in Korea was important for the stability of that area, for the stability of a growing ally, interestingly enough, that by that ally I mean Japan, and for the stability of our own shores, that I could have convincingly done my job there. Yes, it is a matter of might making right, but I really did believe that right was on our side. Now, looking back on that, there may have been a measure of naivete to that very young 25, 26-year-old chaplain doing his job in Korea. And I don't know that, looking back on it, whether indeed there was all that much right on our side. But I certainly believed it at that time. And it was that very firm belief that enabled me to do my work and to undergo, with a measure of equanimity, the suffering that I experienced.
What role did religion and ritual play for you personally during those years in Korea?
Very important. What happened to me in those years in Korea, the 15 and a half months that I was there, was that I was forced to rethink all the basic underpinnings of my own faith. Many of the axioms that I went there with simply were shattered. I wasn't willing to throw everything out because I realized that a faith that's almost 4,000 years old has a good deal about it that's of intrinsic significance. What I found myself needing to do was to rethink some of the fundamentals of that faith. And indeed, I began to do that through the books that I began to write when I came back from Korea. But I live in a world in which the dimension of faith is fundamental to the nature of our species. I think that it isn't hocus-pocus and a matter of dependency upon father figures. I really think that there is a measure of spirituality about man, concealed and battered, as it might be at this point in the history of our species, and that that measure of spirituality is a significant dimension of reality. And it's that measure of spirituality that I'm trying to understand and to come to terms with and to open up and to have that confront the grim, cold, and brutal reality of this century.
You've written that one of the things that was played a large role in reshaping your thinking after you had been in Korea was that you confronted a whole world that was a beautiful world and it really had nothing to do with Jews or Judaism. What was the process of digesting that? Was that really that much of a shock?
It was traumatic. First came the shock. Then came the decades of trying to think out the dimensions of the shock and the responses. I will never forget my first hour in Japan. This was the enemy. You have to remember that. These were the people who destroyed Pearl Harbor. These were the people I grew up hating because of the sneak attack. I was a child. I was about 12 or 13 when we were bombed at Pearl Harbor. I fell instantaneously in love with that country from the first hour that I was there. The people, the shops, the lights, the aesthetics, the grass, the way the hedges were cut. There was a loveliness to the area that I was taken through on the bus ride from the airplane to Camp Drake, my first night there, that simply could not be denied. I had grown up with the notion that paganism was intrinsically an abomination. I suspect that most people who grow up in a Western religious tradition have the notion that heathenism, the heathen, is an abomination. I went to a world which was thoroughly heathen, where even Christianity is nothing more than a thin patina, a sort of lacquered sheen on the face of the essential paganism of that world. And I discovered in that world a loveliness, a beauty, an exquisite aesthetic that I had simply never known existed. To put it even further, I learned to appreciate beauty, not in the streets of New York where I grew up, but in the Far East. What do you do with the notion of paganism as an abomination? Do you say to yourself, you should be on guard all the more against the allures of that world, and all of it is abominable? Do you say to yourself, no, there is something intrinsically worthwhile about that world, and I have to come to terms with it? That was one problem. I had also grown up, and this I learned from my father, that Judaism is a kind of moral reconnaissance force for mankind. He was a kind of army man in the First World War. He was in a Polish unit of the Austrian army, fought on the Russian front. And he often talked in military terms, and he would say that he regards Jews as the reconnaissance troops to teach mankind the importance of morality. If not Jews, then certainly Judaism. Some Jews aren't terribly moral, but certainly the Jewish tradition, the prophetic tradition, the rabbinic tradition. Well, if you're reconnaissance troops, you're going to take high casualties. That's what he would say, because the recon outfits go first. Engineers, recon, so they go first. So Jews take the highest casualties. I saw suffering in the Far East that was simply senseless, absurd, pointless, brutal, horrifying suffering. It wasn't Jewish suffering that troubled me. It was the suffering of these people that I just couldn't understand. It was the suffering of individuals who simply got in the way of empires. And so at first they were rolled over by one, then they were rolled over by the other. As each empire moved troops back and forth across a village, the village would be decimated once, decimated again, and so on. Why that suffering? What kind of sense did that make? I had never seen that kind of suffering before. So that was a serious problem for me. I remember also in a Shinto shrine in a street in Tokyo, seeing an old Japanese man in a tattered brown suit and a fedora praying with a prayer book, shaking back and forth, long beard this man had, in front of an idol. It was a Shinto idol. And the devotion in that man, the face of that man, the intensity of the prayer, the way he shook back and forth, the way he swayed with his body, reminded me very much of the very religious Jews I grew up with in the little synagogue that I would go to when I was a child. And I asked myself at that moment, I'll never forget that moment, I asked myself, is my God listening to this individual's prayer? If he isn't, why not? What greater intensity can God ask of a member of our species? And if God is listening, then what is Judaism and what is Christianity really all about? These were extraordinary problems, and it's inconceivable to me that I could have asked those questions in quite the same way had I remained in the States as I asked them when I actually encountered them in the living flesh, as it were, in the Far East.
It seemed like terrifically unresolvable dilemmas.
What happens in a situation of this kind is that ideas that were fundamental and rock-bound, as it were, become ambiguous, tentative, relative, and you have to come to terms with that tentativity, that ambiguity, and that's what I meant when I referred earlier to the fact that indeed the arena of the divine for the next centuries of man may lie in somehow infusing the ambiguous, the tentative, with sanctity. That's quite a challenge for our species.
If you're just tuning in right now, I've been speaking with Chaim Potok. His most recent novel is The Book of Lights, and it's published by Knopf. And he's been talking about the 15 months he spent as an army chaplain in Korea during the Korean War, and his reflections and what his thoughts were when he was in Japan during that time. One of the characters in your book also has a great love of Japan. Talking about the character that you've named Arthur Leiden, why don't you tell us who that was?
He is the son of one of the scientists who helped develop the atomic bomb, the bomb that was ultimately dropped on Hiroshima, and then the plutonium bomb that was dropped on Nagasaki. And then this man begins to have second thoughts about the whole enterprise of atomic weapons. And it's at this point that the story picks up the interrelationship between Arthur Lydon and his parents on the one hand and Arthur Lydon and Gershon Lauren on the other.
Was this a composite character? Was this a person that really existed?
The parents, in some way, shape, and form, I suppose, existed. Arthur Lydon is, as far as I know, entirely a creation of the imagination. Although people keep telling me that there was somebody like that at the seminary. I don't recall such an individual. But again, it's very strange about being a novelist or being a storyteller in that, indeed, there are whole areas of one's own experience that one simply forgets. And they get stowed away in an unconscious pool, and you draw upon them without fully remembering that once upon a time this pool was fed by living people. For example, there's a character, the boxer, in The Chosen, in the hospital scene in The Chosen. And for the life of me, I have no recollection of ever having met an individual like that. And people keep telling me that I could not have invented an individual like that. I had to have known somebody. Now, I simply did not know boxes when I grew up as a nice Jewish boy in New York. It was not the sort of thing that you went to see. And it was not the kind of world that you really had anything to do with. And people don't believe me. So we simply leave it at that. Arthur Lydon, as far as I know, is a creation of the imagination.
One of the themes that comes up again and again in the Book of Lights is that is Arthur Lydon's guilt over the fact that his parents, or his father, had worked on the bomb which destroyed Japan, which he had become more and more in love with, as a way of compensating for that sense of guilt. And you could extend that perhaps to not only Arthur Lydon's parents, but all the Jewish physicists that worked on the bomb. There were a high percentage of people who worked with Einstein who were Jewish. Did the Jewish community react to this at all? Was this noticed? Does this have any significance?
I rather doubt that anyone reacted very strongly to this, with the exception of one individual, whose name I will mention very soon, in the early decades of this century. It is indeed true, whether we like it or not, that there was an inordinate percentage of Jews involved in theoretical physics. One might make a good case out for the fact that theoretical physics in this century is really a Jewish science. It was not the purpose of these physicists to create weapons of destruction. It was really the purpose of these physicists to understand the essential nature of the universe. The weapons of destruction were created precisely because these physicists were concerned about the Germans making the atomic bomb. Now, the individual that I referred to a moment ago was Adolf Hitler. At a crucial point in history, in the early years of the Second World War, German scientists asked Hitler to make a decision about which way Germany would go in terms of further atomic research. They wanted to indeed explore the possibility of making a bomb, and it was Hitler who regarded physics, and these are his words, as a degenerate Jewish science. And it was because he regarded physics as a degenerate Jewish science that he refused to let German manpower and German money be funneled into atomic research, and instead it went into rocketry. Now, some people may argue this point, but I personally, as a result of the reading that I've done a great deal of reading on this and a lot of talking to a lot of people, I'm pretty much convinced that had Hitler made the decision to go into atomic research, the Germans would have had the bomb first. And a lot of people in this country will be talking German now. I don't doubt for one minute that Hitler would have used that bomb against us. Not for one minute do I doubt that. I indeed doubt that we would have used the bomb against Germany, because in the final analysis, they were of our color, Mm-hmm. And they were in the final analysis of our civilization. We were all Western men. We used it against Japan instead. Now, I just want to make this one point, and that is, I don't know that one can argue about Hiroshima. I think it was an acceptable act of war, as staining as it was. We're forever stained as a result of Hiroshima. And I think that President Truman pretty much made the correct decision, as impossibly difficult as that decision was. One can indeed argue, however, about Nagasaki, which remains an enigma to me to this day. I simply don't know why the second bomb was dropped. So what happened was that these Jewish scientists who were working on the bomb to save the world from the Nazis ended up having that bomb dropped against the wrong enemy. They had never thought that the bomb would be dropped on the Japanese. That was not the point to the bomb at all. As a matter of fact, some of them, in the months before the bomb was dropped, when they realized that Germany was defeated and that the Germans had never come close to making the bomb, some of them began to have very serious second thoughts about where that bomb would end up. And by that point, of course, it was in the hands of the military and nothing could stop where that bomb was going, where those bombs were going to.
Have you kept in touch with some of the physicists, at least the ones that are still alive, that worked on that project?
I, a very, very dear friend of mine is a physicist who worked on the Manhattan Project, yes.
How do they remember that or reconcile that? Or
they remember it as a period of time in which all the energy, all the wisdom, all the techniques and technology at their command went into the development of a weapon that would end the war. And often they would come into their laboratories or into their offices where they worked day after day, very often into the night, very often with very little sleep, around the weekends, no rest. And they would come into their offices and see mounted on their bulletin boards the casualty toll of the day before in Europe and in the Pacific War. And the implication clearly was the sooner you find this bomb, the sooner you solve your mathematical problem, the more the lives that are going to be saved. 2,000 lives today, 2,000 lives yesterday, and so on and so forth. It actually came down to, very often, a physicist saying to himself, my son is in the Pacific somewhere, and if I find the answer to this problem a day sooner, I might save his life. It was a real race. There's no question about that. And it was a powerful patriotic time. We have a tendency to forget the fervor of the war against Japan and Germany, the intensity, the sense that this was a moral war. Certainly the war against Germany was a moral war. These were forces of evil, and we were the forces of light. So these people were very much caught up in the desire to find the answers to these questions and to develop that bomb as soon as they could. It's only in retrospect that we have these terrible second thoughts about what it was that they did.
We only have a few minutes left. I have, a rather big question for just a few minutes. But I'd like to go back to the beginning where we started and quote the introduction that you wrote to your History of the Jews, in which you say that your process of writing is about evolving and reshaping your faith, and that you write novels about certain types of culture conflicts to help you think through these questions of faith that you have. How has that relationship to faith evolved through your books?
My confrontation with the Far East, once I more or less straightened it out in my head, was clearly a culture confrontation. Here was another way of seeing the world, and I confronted that other way of seeing the world from my way of seeing the world. And what I discovered was that there was a great deal to be said for that other way of seeing the world. What I wanted to do was explore that confrontation, and I could only do it in the way that I knew best, and that was through fiction. I had trained myself to write fiction from the time that I was in my early teens. And what I did from that point on was, at first I tried indeed to write the Asiatic novel and discovered that I was, in flashbacks, writing novels about young people who had gone to Asia, writing about their lives. The Chosen is an account of the core of the Jewish tradition in confrontation with one aspect of Western civilization, Freudian psychoanalytic theory. So you have the core of one tradition in confrontation with an element from the core of Western secular humanism. The Promise is an account of the core of a religious tradition in confrontation with another gift to us from Western secular humanism, from the universities of Western secular humanism. We call that gift text criticism, a new way of looking at the sacred books of the ancient world. Ashelev, confrontation with art. In the beginning, a confrontation with anti-Semitism. And another gift from the universities of the Western world, scientific Bible criticism. And the Book of Lights is a confrontation with that whole package and the pagan world in the Far East. Wanderings is an effort to explore all the various kinds of culture confrontations that Jews have experienced all through the millennia. I don't think that the whole world is nothing more than culture confrontation. I'm aware of the economics and the sheer greed and the malice that is very much that are very much a part of our nature. But certainly, cultures which are really commitments to fundamental questions, when varying commitments, clashing commitments meet, enormous tension is generated. Now, what I discovered with The Chosen and The Promise was that intellectual questions can be resolved. Denny Saunders resolves his problem with Freud. Reuven Malta resolves his problem with text criticism. Aesthetic questions are very difficult to resolve. That's the problem with Ashelev. Questions that have to do with the core elements of the tradition, like the Bible, cannot be resolved at all. And the problems that I encountered with Asiatic paganism are utterly incapable of simple resolution. So what you have is a hierarchy of increasingly difficult problems. That's the way the books are structured.
We're out of time, and I thank you very much for this hour. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
I've been speaking with Chaim Potok, who has just published a novel. His most recent novel is called The Book of Lights. His other novels include The Chosen, The Promise. My name is Asher Lev. And I'm sorry, is there a novel I haven't included?
The Chosen, The Promise.
My name is Asher Lev.
My name is Asher Lev. In the Beginning,
and
The Book of Lights.
And he has also written a history of the Jewish people, which is called Wanderings. Thanks again for being here.
Thank you.
Well, that's it for today's Fresh Air. Let me tell you quickly what's going to be coming up tomorrow at 2 o'clock. We'll start the first in a series of lectures given at Well Women in Philadelphia. Tomorrow, Virginia Malenkoff, who calls herself a feminist evangelical, will speak on the biblical imperative to work politically for women's rights. Following that, from National Public Radio, from the Horizon series, we'll hear a program which is called Women in the Clergy, about women who become priests, ministers, and rabbis, and the roles that they fill in different religious denominations and institutions. At 3:30, we'll hear John Zwed and The Record Show, and at 4 o'clock, a special program on the subject of music therapy. We've played this before. It's an interview which Terry Gross recorded a few years ago with music therapist Clive Robbins, who worked with Paul Nordoff, and in that interview there are music therapy tapes which Paul Nordoff and Clive Robbins did, which are played in the interview. So that's tomorrow at 4 o'clock. The production assistant for Fresh Air is Maeve McGordon, and technical supervision was by Scotty Williams and Steve Waterman. My name is Danny Miller, and you're listening to WUHY-FM in Philadelphia.
Good evening. From National Public Radio in Washington, I'm Sanford Unger.
And I'm Cokie Roberts with All Things Considered.
There are maybe 3,000 people across the main gates of London Shipyard, protecting their husbands from the military, the army, who had the tanks in front of them. And they've got explosives in there, and priests with them. And rather than surrender, they're going to blow themselves up.
An eyewitness report on the situation in Gdansk under martial law in Poland. Tonight in All Things Considered, a British businessman tells of seeing the militia beat six young protesters to death, and he reports on demonstrations at Warsaw University.
We also have a report that the Polish Communist Party is still in control and has not given way to the military.
In New York, a representative of Solidarity appeals for sanctions against the Polish government and food aid from private organizations.